This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
My reality is different. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of despair. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. Charles Dickens described in A Tale of Two Cities an age of radical opposites taking place at the same time. More than ever in this period of the 21st century, we see ourselves in a situation of radical opposites. Though these opposites are determined by human factors, they are not determined or in control by the common man, or should I say woman. Yet, they are the ones who suffer the most. My latest artwork is called My Reality is Different, a 9-channel video animation chamber made as part of London's National Gallery First Contemporary Fellowship. In this, I overwrite with my iPad animation drawings a selection of their painting collection and add a series of portraits of the subaltern caught in the worldwide financial web. The National Gallery is a collection of about 2,600 West European paintings by 750 artists. These artworks tell stories from the 13th to the 19th century, biblical, mythical, historical. They show us the world from the point of view of Western patriarchy, the clergy, the royalty, an often colonial view where women, the subaltern, and nature are suppressed as if it were a God-given birthright. By playing the 9 channels, each of different duration, as overlapping images, My Reality is Different is a dynamic palimpsest with endless combinations of images, which makes visible an alternative non-linear part of the human mind. With this experimental art form, I address the spectators as an active audience, where they become dynamic co-creators and co-producers of meaning rather than passive receptors. My Reality is Different, with 250,000 visitors in 3 months this last spring, became the most visited contemporary art exhibition at the National Gallery. The virtual graffitiing of these masterpieces was both a critique and a homage. Gabriele Finaldi, the director of the National Gallery, described My Reality is Different as a constant destroying and rediscovering, as a counteraction that what's gone before. Such robust critique keeps the collection alive, he said. My Reality is Different. This could have been the overall title of my art in the last 50 years. This not only because, as a female artist coming from a refugee family, I do experience time and again reality differently as it unfolds and is politicized and historicized. But most importantly, that I wanted with my art is to make a difference in that reality. The artist's antenna works like a Cassandra, predicting how the future form will come out of current attitudes. This does not imply that my antenna works like a doomsday oracle, although my quest is to put inherited iconographies and stereotypes of culture under intense pressure. My critically charged art can be described as excess, exceeding the conventional, going beyond the boundaries of legitimized narrative. Once caught in the seduction of its beauty, the artwork sets up a stream of consciousness, one thing telescoping into the other, recreating the complexity of how thought, emotion, and memory work at any given moment. Relieving anxiety and decreasing the pain with as a backdrop the fundamental flaws of human nature with its capacity for acts of unimaginable horror committed in the name of ideals. As Lewis Carroll wrote, imagination is the only weapon in the war against reality. My story started with a drawing, a line drawn in a few weeks by a man called Radcliffe. Commissioned by the Parliament of the United Kingdom in 1947, it was decided that British India, in a partition, was to be split up into two sovereign states of Pakistan and India. Pakistan was intended as a Muslim homeland, while India remained secular. And with this rather simple action, the drawing of a line, the future of millions was decided. A whole subcontinent creating two nations with traumas, the wounds of which would last till the present day. For the 50 years of independence exhibition, mappings shared histories, a fragile self. I made from a quilt that belonged to my grandmother a history canvas titled Excavated Images. The quilt had served as a sack for the family when they escaped to Bombay as refugees of partition. I stained the fabric with paint in the colors of sweat, blood, and body ooze, and combined this with an archaeology of personal images, memories, and emotions, the tragic moments in the history of this young nation. In order to involve the public, I provided golden safety pins with sacred wish threads attached to them to be pinned to the quilt. This combines a Muslim and a Hindu religious tradition into a single one, melding two customs. Starting in New Delhi, the exhibition traveled to Karachi, and by the time Excavated Images were shown in Bombay, it was completely covered with pins on both sides. At the time my father was still in Karachi in British India, my mother noticed in a newspaper an advertisement for a lawyer's job at Tata Airlines. Seeing the opportunity, she took the initiative to phone and explain the situation and offered to come herself to the interview to stand in for her husband. To his surprise, when my father landed in Bombay, he was expected to go directly to their offices in Calcutta. In Calcutta, ours was a very modest life, with one room divided by a curtain. My mother, at that time, took me to children's movies on Saturday morning, but as well to her voluntary work at the Bengali refugee camps. My father's job opened up the world as my mother and I could fly once per year anywhere with free tickets from what became Air India International. At the age of 12, my first international journey was to Japan, followed soon by Paris and London. Here started a lifelong process of discovering how visual language travels and how it takes root in different cultures, and trying to make sense of this puzzle called human life. Drawing gives you an instrument of observation to get a grip on outer reality, as I was taught during my biology lessons when learning to minutely observe dissections of plants, insects, and small animals. A few years later, on my journey in Kenya, where I, for the first time, was confronted with racial discrimination, I learned that even more importantly, drawing works as well for ordering an inner reality. Drawing became a life essential way at relating to the outer world and the inner world, without which I could not do a day in my life. An inner reality of fears, anxieties, uncertainties, a reality with which more than half of the world lives and which seems not to be understood or acknowledged by the ones in power. Of course, my father, being practical and having experienced that the family lost everything during partition, wanted me to study law, as he had done. After all, if for a second time we had to flee, what could we take to the next country? Nothing more than what we had in our minds. To become an artist was no choice. It was my only way to make sense of life. Thanks to the convincing words and loyal support of my mother, I went to the JJ School of Art in Bombay for the period 1964 to 1969. Old-fashioned British oil painting-oriented education with a completely outdated library from which one was not even allowed to borrow books. I would rather spend my time next door at the School of Architecture, with deeply engaged students full of ideas related to Bauhaus and social architecture. Or at the Bhulabhai Memorial Institute, by coincidence, next door to the Sindhi refugee colony where my parents lived, where I was lucky to get a studio already in 1964. I became friends with the now legendary senior artists Guy Tunde, Tayyab Mehta, and M.F. Hussain. Every week, we went to see new Indian regional cinema and alternative European cinema. Guy Tunde generously lent me his books on Western art history, Indian philosophy, and Zen Buddhism. In my spare time, I worked in the same building as a volunteer for the theater director, Satyadev Dubey, whom I assisted with making posters, costumes, and postcards for invitees. From Dubey's plays, I learned the value of reusing old epics, myths, and stories to make them germane to the contemporary moment. In the same locality, 100 meters to the left of my parents' home, the artist Akbar Padamsi started the Vision Exchange Workshop in 1969. For this, Padamsi selected a small group of artists and filmmakers, wanting them to work and discuss the new mass media, like film and photography, as this was the material that would make the future. Being invited as the youngest and only female, just after I obtained a diploma in fine arts at the JJ School of Art, the Vision Exchange Workshop felt like a dream. Even before even the first film camera arrived, I already made a series of large cameraless photograms, which I continued in 1970, imaginary blueprints of an ideal city plan for a modern India. With the size of 96 by 73 centimeters, these photograms were unusually large for those times that allowed me to exhibit them in relation to my abstract paintings. At the Vision Exchange Workshop in the summer of 1969, in a period of 6 weeks, non-stop work, I finished the painstaking and complicated stop-motion animation Dream Houses. The inspiration for this animation came from Laszlo Moholy-Nagy, who believed in the potential of art as a vehicle for social transformation, and from the color theories of Johannes Itten. But most importantly, from the Indian architect Charles Kuria, with his visionary and humanistic idea for the urban poor. I was the most prolific member and made additionally a series of short black and white experimental films on what it felt to be a young woman in Bombay. These early film works on the female body puzzled my male colleagues at the workshop, and according to them, I was wasting my time. On a scholarship in 1970 to 72, Paris became the university of my life. Here, in contrast to the art scene in Bombay, engagement in politics was very much part of the scene. Still under the influence of 1968, I participated in mass demonstrations and was inspired at the Sorbonne by the lectures of Noam Chomsky, Claude Lévi-Strauss, Michel Lieris, Jean-Paul Sartre, and Simone de Beauvoir. At the Cité Universitaire, intense intellectual discussions focused on the Third World, colonial and post-colonial studies, and anti-imperial struggles. Meeting young filmmakers at the Cinémathèque Française, such as Alain René, Jean-Luc Godard, William Klein, and Chris Marker, made me aware of film as a prise de conscience, a political awareness. All this helped me to develop an eye for observing the reality of my homeland from the outside. Paris was very attractive as part of the West that ruled the hegemony of contemporary art. It inspired me to make a new series of photo collages and write several scripts for short films and film sculptures. But instead of staying on, I returned to Bombay, motivated to contribute as an artist to the progress of the young Indian nation. Coming from a region in the world where many women face difficulty in achieving social advancement, I continued my series of films. This started with the documentary project in a Muslim slum in the area called Bandra in Bombay. The film was intended as a conscience-raising project that would travel from one slum to another to make their inhabitants aware of their rights. The project was never finished. After months of work, one morning I arrived at a completely empty space. The city municipality at overnight bulldozed the whole area. In the same year, I made the black and white film Taboo in Rajasthan while assisting the film director Mani Kaul on his shoot for the film Duvidha. Taboo deals with the unnoticed discrimination against women in India, what still is being practiced and justified by caste and religion, especially in certain Orthodox communities. One might wonder, what is the taboo about? The answer lies in the strict separation in certain castes between what women are allowed to do in the weaving process. It is an absolute taboo for these women to touch the loom. As such, women are excluded from the most important and creative part of the process, a metaphor that even today stands for the discrimination that women face. Like in the words of Charles Dickens, already the late 60s and early 70s in India showed that radical opposites were taking place. The Nehruvian period came to an end, and it became clear that most of the utopian dreams could never be realized for the common family. The old dominating factors of religion, caste, gender, and class determined your life. Hence, I decided in 1976 to add another film to my animation, Dream Houses, of 1969, intended to be filmed next to each other as a double film projection installation. This film installation, Utopia, shows a young woman in black and white film who realizes that these new buildings she's looking at will never be within her reach. After a spring of hope for India, the winter of despair had set in. Rejected and ignored by the Vision Exchange Workshop members, these experimental films surfaced again in 2012 when I moved my studio. Their value as early experimental socio-political engaged film was finally acknowledged and are now in a digitalized format in museum collections around the world, like the Museum of Modern Art in New York, Centre Pompidou in Paris, M Plus in Hong Kong, and the KNMA in New Delhi. From 1978 to 2003, I no longer lived in the elite Warden Road area, but had my studio in the bustling area of the electric wholesale market in Lohar Chal in Bombay. It was a radical socio-political cultural change where life on the streets became an obsession, where daily workers found their home and family life as pavement dwellers. In the late 80s, to search out new artistic expressions was a dire need. The Indian art scene was in an ivory tower, catering largely to the elite, with no connection with the nation's drastically changing socio-political reality. How to confront the bourgeois audience and shake them up from their equanimity? How to bring the voice of the voiceless, the predicaments of the oppressed to a larger audience within India and internationally in the Western art world, but as well beyond the West. Invited to exhibit in 1991 at the posh South Bombay Jahangir Art Gallery, I wanted the audience to become part of this other world. Alleyway of Lohar Chal became my first installation / shadow play, with ink drawings on 5 polyester sheets, hanging as scrolls in a staggered zigzag formation, becoming a see-through walk-through installation. The palimpsest images appear and disappear like pale ghosts of a dehumanized world. Here one was encompassed, could not escape it, as one walked through. Here the shadow of a lower strata would touch your body. Alleyway of Lohar Chal was not a painting that one could observe from the safety of a distant chair. Socio-politically engaged art like this continued a year later with my wall drawing, City of Desires, which I referred to in a newspaper from 1992 as an impermanent site-specific installation. For this, I took over a white cube gallery in South Bombay as an open studio where I worked in situ. The exigencies of the threat to democratic freedom led me and other female artists to look for new materials and new forms. City of Desires became a series which I have continued to make since 30 years. Within India, for instance, at the Kiran Nadar Museum of Art in New Delhi, and internationally at the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam, Centre Pompidou in Paris, and Castello di Rivoli, with the most recent ones this year, or rather last year, in Montreal and Seoul. Revisiting subjects is typical of my art as I work in a series on specific subjects, often over long periods of time, as I feel unable to contain it in one single work, or when the subject becomes topical again, or when I feel I have to add a dimension. These wall drawings have, at the end of the exhibition period, different erasure performances which are not just a destruction, but an exercise in memory, as this is all what is left over. How this erasure performance looks like is not communicated to the museum or the public in advance. At the Musée Cantonal des Beaux-Arts in Lausanne, the audience was surprised, expected to see a performance when they were all invited to perform the Erasure. Parents and children stood next to international curators and city civil servants with erasures in their hands and started to erase. At the Centre Pompidou in Paris, a thank you public ceremony was organized where the full exhibition team, including the director, got a bouquet of red roses, after which they were asked, to their surprise, to use these same roses for the Erasure performance. In the 90s, an inner drive to connect to larger audiences led to working in experimental theater in collaboration with performers and theater directors, which resulted in Medea Material in 1993 and The Job in 1997. At the same time, in November 95, the newly elected Shiv Sena-led government renamed the city of Bombay to Mumbai, after the city's patron deity, goddess Mamba Devi. These theater plays explored new artistic expression and experiments with contemporary versions of the Greek tragedies and Bertolt Brecht's epic theater, but were put into an Indian setting, as I believe in the universality of themes such as conflict, reconciliation, oppression, dreams, and myth. Although a great success, unfortunately, these theater plays could not travel internationally. Therefore, I changed the concept of the play by going one step further, capturing the actors on camera so that with projections I could show them everywhere. I call this new format video plays, a format which would help me further with the decentralization of art. During a six-month residency at the Fukuoka Asian Art Museum, 1999-2000, I made the video play Hamlet Machine in collaboration with the Butoh dancer Nobuo Harada, his body as a canvas soaked by history with projections of newly made historical footage. Hamlet Machine is originally an adaptation of Shakespeare's Hamlet by the German playwright Heiner Müller. It consists of four video projections in a dark theatrical setting with three screens forming a large triptych and the fourth screen consisting of a thick layer of salt, of a salt bed on the floor, a reference to Gandhi's salt march. For me, the Hamlet character resembled at that time not only the state of India, a country in transition, undecided about its political and economic stance, but as a universal play, asking questions and expressing traumas that concern all of contemporary humankind. Thanks to its universal character and due to its digital format, Hamlet Machine as an experimental video play traveled in the last two decades to more than 15 countries spread over four continents. A step further with these video plays became the large-scale outdoor open-air public video presentations. As for instance, the commission in 2014 in Edinburgh for the commemoration of the beginning of World War I, projected on the entire south and west facade of the National Gallery. Just like the mural paintings of Giotto in the churches or in the Buddhist caves in Aurangabad, these outdoor multi-narrative video plays are meant to be seen as a collective experience. As In Search of Vanished Blood was screened directly after the ceremonial Royal Edinburgh Military Tattoo, it was attended by massive crowds that for the occasion could take over the traffic-free streets along the Scottish National Gallery. With Cassandra's head floating over the walls, this video work combined archival footage of World War I and the monstrosities of World War II with a phantasmagorical animation of a future, a military heritage, one which is connected to Britain's imperial incursions in South Asia. Sometimes it so happens that the constant process of experimenting, you find a solution and the combination of two completely different ways of working. To find a solution for the actor to change her costume on stage during the play, The Job, I came up with reverse painted transparent cylinders that could go over the actor so she would become a different person. Pulling these cylinders up and down created intriguing shadows, which led to my shadow plays such as The Sacred and the Profane. Combining rotating reverse painted cylinders with video as a light source became what I call video shadow plays. This new type of work was to become my most successful art form, in which I could make tangible a different kind of working of the mind beyond the Western linear view. This multi-layering palimpsest created spaces of wonder, appealing to memory while referencing epic mythological narratives, allegorical fictions, and political exigencies. It is this radically inventive art practice which became my international signature, especially when shown at Documenta 13 in Kassel in 2012. And a few years later at the Museum of Modern Art in New York in the exhibition Scenes of a New Heritage. Or at the solo show Vision in Motion at the inauguration of the M Plus Museum in Hong Kong, where it had 1.2 million visitors in a period of 11 months. My latest game changer happened in 2017 when I was introduced to the iPad to a dear architect, artist friend, Salim Karimji. It gave me a studio on the move, where I could get a grip on things that agitated me by making drawings as notebook animations on daily politics, other people's writings, and even mundane aspects of life which I might have experienced. I could question them to show a different angle as a protest or even as a joke. Drawing them directly on the iPad with my index finger, not with the Apple Pencil, there is a sensitivity with the fingertip, which is erotic and raw. There is something very direct about this process of drawing, rubbing, scratching, and erasing, to do with the messing around in one's head. I feel like a woman with thoughts and fantasies shooting from my head. In a period of less than 5 years, I made the images and the audio for more than 100 animations, exhibiting no longer depended on galleries or museums with long-term plannings, as I presented these animations like thought bubbles directly and for free on Instagram, where thousands of people are following them. The appreciation was such that I decided to put the animations together in a format of an animation chamber where they become the video graffiti on the walls. An animation chamber as an agora, where one could discuss the topics among the viewers as a cultural counter to the climate of intolerance. As such, Can You Hear Me was exhibited for 11 months in 2020 at the Whitechapel Gallery in London and became so popular that in a period of 3 years, it was shown as an installation in 12 different museums around the world. To my surprise, the quality of these digital animation files was such that it even gave me the opportunity to go on the street level and fill complete buildings. For example, last year, the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts invited me for a facade commission for which I made the animation Ballad of a Woman, inspired on a poem by the Polish Nobel Prize winner, Wisława Szymborska. The audience feedback was encouraging with works like these. Shown over 6 months, the characters from its epics meet and merge with multicultural voices and global feminist concerns. My reality is different. For the majority of humankind, the quotidian experience of reality in the past and in the present are different from those who dominate and manipulate worldviews in an oppressive manner. But the paradigm for a future could be different. At the age of 78, I'm still very interested in alternative systems of critical thought and passionate about pioneering artistic expression which can touch our spirits. I feel art has a function, more than ever, to return us to that part of the human we deny, the part that thwarts our capacity to make sense of what we see and hear. Now more than ever, it is important to question and try to understand the vagaries and demands of cultural translation and to create in order that oppositional voices are not feared, degraded, or dismissed, but valued. Kazuo Inamori, the initiator of the Kyoto Prize, was convinced that the future of humanity can only be assured only when there is a balance between scientific development and the enrichment of the human spirit. In that line of thought, I want to thank all my fellow laureates of the Kyoto Prize. Your contribution over the decades has been such an inspiration for the world. You are the spring of hope after a winter of despair. Thank you.
So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to look at a short video about Nalini Milani's project from Document to 13. This is a film called Cassandra's Gift, made in 2012 by Payal Kapadia, and an award-winning filmmaker. And it's a short film that we're going to take a look at, and it will explore some of the work that you just heard about. So please, Cassandra's Gift.
There is no sign of blood anywhere. I've searched everywhere. The executioner's hands are clean, his nails transparent. The sleeves of each assassin are spotless. No sign of blood. No trace of red. Not on the edge of the knife, none on the point of the sword. The ground is without stains, the ceiling white. This blood, which has disappeared without leaving a trace, isn't part of written history. Who will guide me to it? Cassandra exists in all of us. Cassandra's gift is the gift of intuitive knowledge. But just as Apollo cursed Cassandra so that no one would believe her prophecies, we too have the curse that stops us from listening to our own intuitive voice. Cassandra's gift is, I think, in the domain of female thought. The female part and the masculine part both are operative as abstract ideas within each human being. Hence, one should be working with a balance rather than weighing too much on the one or the other. At the moment, we're living too much in a phallic world. The denigration of the female part is counter to anything called human progress. Therefore, we see so much violence taking place. I have been very interested in Christa Wolf's Cassandra, where she makes a link from the archetype Cassandra into the 20th century. I am testing for pain. I am probing my memory the way a doctor probes a limb to see whether it has atrophied. Perhaps pain dies before we die. What I wanted to try to do is portray different aspects of violence. Some violence which is to do with defending oneself, and the other which is to do with defending ideologies. Then I said, defending oneself. I'm thinking of the whole Naxal movement in India, where tribals are trying to defend their land from misuse and takeover by multinationals, where they will be totally deprived of their means of livelihood. I am very inspired by Mahashweta Devi's story on the tribal woman Draupadi and her quest for defending her land. Draupadi was apprehended at 6:53 p.m. It took an hour to get her to camp. Questioning took another hour exactly. No one touched her, and she was allowed to sit on a canvas camp stool. At 8:57, Sena Naik's dinner hour approached, and saying, "Make her, do the needful," he disappeared. Then a billion moons passed, a billion lunar years. Opening her eyes after a million light years, Draupadi, strangely enough, sees sky and moon. Slowly, the bloodied nail heads shift from her brain. Trying to move, she feels her arms and legs still tied to four posts. Something sticky under her ass and waist. Her own blood. Only the gag has been removed. Incredible thirst. In case she says water, she catches her lower lip in her teeth. She senses that her vagina is bleeding. How many came to make her? Shaving her, a tear trickles out of the corner of her eye. In the muddy moonlight, she lowers her lightless eye, sees her breasts and understands that indeed she is made upright. Her breasts are bitten raw, the nipples torn. How many? 4, 5, 6, 7. Then Draupadi had passed out. So here she was defending her land, and here she was getting raped and raped and raped by the police. So what else to do but to pick up arms and fight for her body, for her soul, for her land, for her people, for her children. So that's violence. It's recourse to violence. There is nothing else. What else can you do?
Thank you. So I started to look for images, and I found some very, very interesting pictures. There is a website that the tribals themselves have put up, and from time to time it gets censored by the government. Here you see a group with very simple weapons, really, and you see a woman with hardly any clothes. She has just got something on her shoulders and a baby on her lap. What I wanted to do was try to make a drawing of this image, draw it out, erase it, draw it again, which formed a kind of animation. This was a painful process, and I had to draw it rather than shoot an image of this nature. It had to be drawn. It was a process of internalizing that transformation from a girl with a baby, with her baby, into a girl with a gun who joins the forces of the Naxals. In the process of taking care of her young one, has to finally find another means to take care, and that is violence. To find motives is quite a search. How to make it possible? Whatever one does, it's going to be tentative. So all the anxiety, the difficulties, what you see in the world is going to happen. Is formed in a graffiti fashion on your face, as if it's getting etched in your face. I want you to think about the worst thing on earth that could happen to you. Could you do that? Okay. You know it already? It's not working. It's more one's need to try to put it out there rather than to make a slogan out of it. To nuance it in a way where violence and the justification for violence in one case comes through in a manner where it can be convincing to the viewer. That the recourse to that violence was something that was the last resort, the only thing that community of people, the tribals, could actually do in order to defend themselves, because really there is nobody listening at the helm of affairs, nobody listening to this voice. And then there is the other kind of violence based on religious ideology, violence in the name of God. This is something baffling in today's day and age, in this day of progress. In a way, it's a kind of time warp. Nothing has moved. There are sophisticated guns, but are used by people who have what?
God on their side. A God that allows the murder of thousands of people. And where women have no voice. Here the female psyche is not allowed to operate at all. It is the aggressive male side that operates. It has become phallocentric. And the human then becomes a mutant. There is so much blood spilt, violence in the name of religious ideology, especially in India.
This is Cassandra speaking.
In the heart of darkness, under the sun of torture, to the capitals of the world, in the name of the victims,
I eject all the sperm I have received. I turn the milk of my breasts into poison. I take back the world I gave birth to. I bury it in my womb.
Down with the happiness of submission. Long live hate, rebellion, and death.
In both situations, it is the women who will suffer. It is the women who are the biggest victims, and it is the victims I want to talk about through my work. Whose opinion am I going to change? I mean, there is a sense of frustration that I do feel, but at the same time, there is a need to put an idea out there, to put a thought. That is the only way I can think. To put out a drawing in a way that people take notice and look at it differently, and not be prejudiced towards any community. There is a tendency to relegate them to a position where they are the other, or outcast, but that is not the solution. And then, of course, there is the added element of the shadows that turn. They turn constantly round and round, circulating around the room over the images, trying to efface the traces of violence. The repetition compulsion must be internalized in order for the violence to cease.
The futility of violence is so well articulated in Faiz Ahmed Faiz's poem, In Search of Vanished Blood, from which I borrow the title for this work. In Search of Vanished Blood. There is no sign of blood anywhere. I've searched everywhere. The executioner's hands are clean. His nails transparent. The sleeves of each assassin are spotless. No sign of blood. No trace of red. Not on the edge of the knife. None on the point of the sword. The ground is without stains. The ceiling white. The ground is without stains. The ceiling white. This blood, which has disappeared without leaving a trace, isn't part of written history. Who will guide me to it? It wasn't spilled in service of emperors. It earned no honor, had no wish granted. It wasn't offered in rituals of sacrifice. No cup of absolution holds it in a temple.
It wasn't shed in any battle. No one calligraphed it on banners of victory. But unheard, it still kept crying out to be heard. No one had the time to listen. No one the desire. It kept crying out, this orphan blood. But there was no witness, no case filed. From the beginning, this blood was nourished only by dust. Then it turned to ashes, left no trace, became food for dust. From the beginning, this blood was nourished only by dust. Then it turned to ashes, left no trace, became food for dust.
As you're thinking of questions and preparing to sip to the mic, I have a couple of questions for you, Nalini. And the first one is, I was so moved by your talk, and then seeing the film was really incredibly powerful. I was thinking a lot about this intersection of experimental practice that you talk about in the earlier video that introduced you, and your career-long interest in social justice and uplifting and advocating for the rights of women and other marginalized people and voices. And I noticed in this film that there is this sort of oscillation of the tubes of the sort of cylinders of Mylar. And they made me think about the repetition of the voices that don't get heard and how frustrating that can be. But then as we see the images, they bleed into one another, they project upon one another, and a new language is kind of invented, is kind of made in the space. And so my question is, how do you approach being an experimental artist who is grappling with these really heavy issues, like the one we just saw in the film we just saw, and more broadly in your work? How does experimentalism play a role in your development of those ideas?
Well, as I already said, that sometimes you try out something. For example, the theater play, The Job, that we did, it was in 1996. And that's when I started to use the cylinders on the set. And it was the function that really gave me the form. Uh-huh. And so I learned something from that process. And then when I started to use the cylinders only as shadow plays, that already gave me a further way of working, a new form. And so that then led to one more layering of imagery with the videos. Yeah. So that, you know, the narrative could be pushed along with a performance artist, as I have used here. Right. And that's how I feel that perhaps I've been able to, without being didactic, create a kind of phantasmagoric scenario where people can enter. And what I imagine or try to orchestrate is that your first impression is, oh, am I in a fishbowl, for example, you know?
Sure.
And then you start to decipher the images. If you stay on and get mesmerized, but then you finally are out of that moment and you say, what's being done here? And then you see the pain of it. So it's those layerings that I'm interested in, you know, as things unfold. So the process of entering and departing should be different. You enter because you think that you're entering something which is almost magical, but when you leave with pain.
Yeah, there's a kind of transformation that happens to the viewer, the visitor,
yes.
And the work does that. And if it were more didactic, do you think that transformation would happen? Or
nobody wants to be preached to.
Right.
You know, it never works.
Yeah.
And I'm not interested in making posters.
I mean, I've tried. And then you're
right. It doesn't work. In fact, it just blocks up people's minds. Right. It's best not to. Yeah.
Let them find their way through the work.
Find their way, yes. Yeah.
You talked about earlier in your career, when you were making your first films, that the men in your group were very dismissive and very patronizing and said, you're wasting your time. And as I was watching and hearing you talk about your career, I thought, I am curious to hear from you the kinds of responses to your work you've received from women and girls, the way, I'm sure that you must have had many, and so if there's any that come to mind of in your work that is advocating on for the rights of and on behalf of women, while the men may have been dismissive and may continue to be, I would love to know what the voices of women have been in response to your work.
Well, I've always had. Extremely good responses from the women artists, one, and also women who come to see my work. But it's also led to my collaborations. I only collaborate with women. For example, in the theater plays, it was with the actor herself, and she self-directed the play, Medea Material, and then later when I did the job as well. Mm-hmm. So, and I find collaborating with women is an extremely fulfilling project, because it's you come with what you know and what she comes with her knowledge, and together we create a third thing from which we both learn, you know. So this I find the most creative moment, and I've done many collaborations with the only one which was with a man was with my Bhutto dancer in Fukuoka.
Oh,
Bhutto.
Sure.
Yeah. So Harada-san.
By necessity. Yeah.
But we were all completely on. I don't speak Japanese, and he didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
But we were born the same year, and we had read the same literature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was a great help. So we had a means of communication.
Yes,
so.
Connection.
And we are friends up to today.
Oh, that's lovely.
This happened in 1999,
wow.
But even he came to Kyoto as well. So that was really a wonderful moment for
that's
me.
That's great. Yeah. I love that. I know that you want to hear from folks in the audience, and I certainly do, and I'm curious if there are questions. I know we may have some note cards as well, and so if we do, I'm happy to receive them. I see someone at the microphone here. Please.
Hi. Hi, Nalini. I have two questions. The first is, you said early on you with your films, you made cameraless photographs and cameraless films, so what is that? And secondly, what kind of negative reception has your work received? I can only think that there's lots of people who respond to these with hatred, the kind of people that you are and kind of systems you're speaking out against.
Yeah.
So the first question you had was about the cameraless photography. Actually, it has a long history with Man Ray and with Mahali Naj. They had made with physical objects, they would make, they'd place them under the, it doesn't exist anymore, in the dark room, under the enlarger, and with light, they would create the image on the photosensitive paper, and then, of course, would get developed, etc. What I did was, as I didn't have a negative, I created negatives with different types of opacity and transparency. So I made a scale, a grayscale, with transparent paper going on to translucency and then opaque. So with that, I created a key. And then the key was such that each gray would have its own intensity of light and time. So these are the two factors that you need in photography. And that is how I created the photograms. But it's not, I'm not the inventor of it. It has already had a past history. So it is already a material that's in the public domain, let's mm-hmm. say. Your other question was a bit more complex. And you talk about the reception I had received by my male colleagues. Is that what you wanted to ask?
I think about the, you correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is basically the reception from the people that you are critiquing, the people in power that your work criticizes. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah.
How do they respond to your work, if at all?
More often than not, the best thing is to ignore. I mean, so I'm ignored. And if there is something which is directly political, then I have censorship issues. So these are the two things that happen.
Yeah.
More often than not, it happens that I'm sort of denigrated. We face it.
Thank you for the question. Someone else for Nalini. Do you have a question, or maybe we have note cards as well? Oh, I see someone walking to the microphone over here. Hi, thank you.
I'm sort of similarly with the sort of critique of government, and I think as elections coming up in India, with the more sort of things, nuances occurring at more fast pace, as like an international artist based in India and US myself, I wonder like how, with a lot of your topics, and you talk about this sort of universality of a lot of these themes, mm-hmm. and I wonder, struggling with my own practice on how to take iconography and things from India and how to make that, like open that up, and I find that your art is very good at being accepted and understood by a lot of cultures, so mm-hmm. I'm just wondering like how you handle that and the fast-paced nature of sort of the themes that we handle. Yeah.
Well, I think a new language will have to be forged. I mean, like Bertolt Brecht said, do you succumb to the dark times? No, you keep on working in the dark times.
Yeah.
So I think that's what artists have to do. I mean, censorship is something we have to face. And critiquing things that government does is also something that artists have to do.
Yeah.
And we have to find ways and means. We have to forge a new language. And the language where you're not only speaking to those who are already converted, mm-hmm. but you have to find ways and means to convert those who are very much on the right. Yeah. So let's together find a new language.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I join you in your wish for this. I see someone at the microphone, and then I see in the front row. So let's do the person at the microphone first, and then I'll come right back to you. Okay, please.
Thank you for everything. I'm your near contemporary, and it's been quite a journey, hasn't it? I've been moved by really a theme of erasure. I very much appreciated Cassandra's gift because you would do one image, you would erase it or you would touch it, it would still be fluid. And I'm so glad the video goes along with it, but I fell in love with some of the things that got erased along the way. But the erasure, I guess, is a very thematic thing of importance to your representation of reality, is it? The erasure of women, the erasure of suffering, that sort of thing.
Well, if I've understood your question, the erasure of women has been happening for centuries. I mean, not only in my part of the world, but all over the world. It exists even till today. And sometimes when you have extreme right-wing scenarios taking place, it happens all the more. You know, the male alpha male is a very dangerous thing, you know. So combating the alpha male is a job that women have to do. It's one of those things that we have to do. And to talk about Cassandra as a metaphor for ways and means to combat that is important, because you know the story of Cassandra. She warned her father, the king, not to bring in the Trojan horse, and she was right. But then because of the curse, then the curse for me, metaphorically speaking, is that very curse that the male has put on, because it's Apollo after all, you know, this powerful god. So I think that's, we have to sort of move along, trying to fight this great wall around us.
And part of what's been erased is the earlier goddesses that preceded Apollo.
The earlier goddesses that preceded
yes,
Apollo.
Yes, of course, but that's the whole history of how yes. matriarchy turned to patriarchy.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think Engels has done a great job writing about it.
Thank you so much. And then in our front row, please.
Spectacular, disturbing, realistic. Bottom line, have you, over the years of your career, seen women understand and react slowly, slowly, slowly? I mean, do you believe, honestly, that women, I mean, we certainly have the power to do this, and we're certainly going to run into a lot of flack doing it, but do you believe that this will emerge over time? And are you at all optimistic that through all your work that you've seen this happen?
Yes, I've seen it happen. And I've seen it. I'm very optimistic.
Is there a specific environment or material that you find vital towards your work?
You know, it's the subject that governs it all. If I find something happening and it's really upsetting me, and I have to find a form for it, sometimes a drawing is enough, but then I'm still uncertain, and then I go on to make a painting about it, but then I'm still uncertain. Then I go on to make an environmental piece, which I hope then it'll, you know. But it just goes, because the subject is enormous. That's why I work in a series, and then I hope that in that series some of the gravity of the situation, the trauma of the situation, it gets encompassed. But again, as I said, it's tentative. I'm never very sure.
What has sustained you through all of your times of uncertainty?
What has sustained me? And I think that, you know, to give you an example, when I showed this work at the Documenta, there was a group of Greek artists who came out with tears in their eyes, and they came and hugged me, and then we talked. And then they talked about Cassandra and from their point of view, which was, this is what I felt was something fantastic, because I always wanted to have the epic characters to be a link language, and here it linked beautifully. So in that sense, I felt, you know, a certainty of something that has triggered, you know, emotions. So, yes.
Wow. Oh, I see one. This might be our last one, I think, but
yeah.
Please.
Okay.
Please.
Yeah. Hi. I am an art student in Tijuana. I just want to ask you some advice for my future and in hard work.
Some advice for the future and your hard work.
Yeah.
Some advice for your future? Well, work from the heart. That's all I say. I mean, your heart will tell you exactly what to do. And that's what, don't hesitate. Listen to your heart. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
It's good advice for all of us, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.